Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Yeah, hi, this is Peter Bregan, and I have an even better than usual guest today. I'll tell you briefly that it's the filmmaker of Generation RX, and then I won't tell you another word except to ask him if he's there. Kevin, are you there?
I am here, Doctor. Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear your voice. Well, I've got a new feature I'm starting with today. It's tentatively called the Ginger's News File. Every week, Ginger is always piling on my table various news clips of importance. She is, the one who's out there in touch with all the social networks and all the tweets and really with all the scientists and professionals around the world. And so I decided to start making official use of these clips that I find interesting that she keeps providing me with. And it'd be a way for my listeners to sort of keep up with some things big and some things small on the Internet. The two news flashes from Ginger for today are, first, the FDA is slashing the starting dose for Lunesta, the sleep aid. So if you think that going through FDA approval proves that you have reached some sort of safety standard, you're probably wishful thinking. They're recommending one-third the current label recommended dose. They're no more than 1 milligram at bedtime. You can Google this. But listen, as long as we're slashing, why not just not take Lunesta? There are better ways to find a peaceful evening, and there are better drugs. I'm not going to get into that, but if you need to take some, there are certainly better drugs, starting with an over-the-counter antihistamine. Lunesta is one of these newer drugs, like Ambien, that just makes people freak out often, like sleepwalk out your upstairs window. And it's associated with violence. These drugs are associated with suicide. And there's a couple of studies out that shows, and this is really, really frightening and hard to grasp, they're reducing lifespan. The more we find out about psychiatric drugs, the less reason we have for taking them. Now, welcome to Australia, Strattera, from Eli Lilly. Eli Lilly has to be the producer of more terrible drugs than any, at least in my personal professional experience, drug company I know of, including Zyprexa and Prozac and Darvon. And so many of their drugs have been associated with hiding of details and facts. Well, Strattera, their ADHD medicine, which they couldn't get through as an antidepressant medicine, so they got it through as an ADHD medicine. It's not a Schedule II drug. It's not your opiate like amphetamine and methylphenidate and Ritalin, but a horribly stimulating drug nonetheless, and it's producing suicides and self-mutilation in Australia. We really, really, really need to stop giving terrible drugs to our children. Check my website out. Go to my scientific articles. I have a new article out asking professionals to start to think about getting together to call eventually, maybe not right now, for a ban on giving psychoactive substances to children to control their emotions, their thoughts, or their behavior. It's just not the thing to do to children. Well, that's my first Ginger's News Flashes. I hope you found it interesting. I'm going to try to maintain this for a while and see how it goes. My guest today.
A great idea.
Is it a good idea? Does it sound good, Kevin?
Yes, it does. And matter of fact, Peter, in regard to Lunesta, you know, I posted that story a couple of days ago as well. And, you know, I think that part of the warning was that, you know, they were warning people that even the morning after taking this reduced dose, they should be careful about operating an automobile and pass the, quote, required mental acuity, end quote. And so my throwaway line was, well, that explains so much because the FDA has been asleep at the wheel for years.
This, folks, is Kevin P. Miller. Now, the P is important because you could put in filmmaker Kevin Miller and get somebody very different, which I found out today. But Kevin Miller is, you know, he's just a wonderful human being. He's my buddy. He's a friend. He's the producer and director. Earlier films included Truth Be the Bias and The Promised Land. He's gotten lots of international awards. My audience probably knows him best as the filmmaker of Generation RX. And he's working on a new film now called Letters from Generation RX, which I'll let him tell you about. Now, I have never in my career, as far as I can remember, asked for donations for either myself or anyone else. Well, Ginger and I have changed that policy. And in fact, we've given Kevin P. Miller a donation from our Center for the Study of Psychiatry. So that's one place your donations, rather your memberships or donations to the center would go to Kevin Miller to finish up his film. And on our website, empathictherapy.org, that's our organizational website in contrast to Bregan.com, we now have a place where you can press a button or two and give a donation for the completion of Generation RX. That's set up now. And Kevin, welcome to the show, and thanks for adding a bit more information that I failed to include in my first Ginger Newsflash. So thanks for that. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thanks. A little sleep deprived, avoided Lunesta, so I'm doing very well, though. Thank you. The film is going very well, and thank you, and Ginger, and to all of your audience for, you know, your consideration and your generosity and making contributions to the film. You know, what's even more heartening, Peter, is that for the 25 years that I've been producing and directing documentary work, is that everyone knows at the beginning, and it's sort of a stated mission statement on my website and elsewhere, that, you know, I've always enjoyed creative and editorial control over all of my films that I produced, or I wouldn't do them. And so when people do contribute, as you have and so many other people have quite generously, it's so heartening to know that their faith in me as a writer and director and producer of these topics and others, hopefully the faith is very well placed. So thank you for that.
Well, you're really welcome, and I'm serious. You're the only person, your films, the only thing we've ever asked anybody to support. So I think you could, if you want to make a huge personal difference yourself, and if you want to watch a film and think, gee, I gave $5 to that, or I gave $100 to that, I helped that happen, or I even gave more to that, you want that kind of satisfaction of knowing you're actually contributing to something that's going to help change our culture in a positive way. That's what Kevin's films do. So I won't trouble anybody else. It's not going to be like PBS. I'm not going to plug it again. Maybe I'll mention it to close once. But so let's just talk about the film or anything else you feel like talking about, Kevin.
Well, sure. We are about 75%. You know, through the actual production of the film, we're well into the editing at this point, and it's really an exciting project. And it really began, Peter, you very kindly mentioned Generation RX, of course, and it really began in the wake of what that film created. And it's hard to believe that it's been 4 years plus since that film was released, but almost immediately, and it's probably something it's something you've encountered so many hundreds, if not thousands of times in the wake of your books and your fine work that you've released over the years. After the release of Generation RX, I started receiving first dozens, then hundreds, then literally thousands of letters from parents and teenagers and others who saw the film on Netflix and on Amazon and bought the DVD, and they started writing me their personal experiences, about their personal experiences with various psychotropics that were, of course, covered in great detail in the film. And so, you know, I was very moved. I had no intention, really, of producing another film, but I was on this topic, but I was so moved by the letters that I received that I thought, my gosh, you know, to do this topic justice, I think at the very least we need to do one more film and really have it reflect the breadth and the seriousness and the personal experiences of all those who graced me by sending me letters. So that really began, the whole process of producing this new film, which is going to break some new ground. It's going to share a lot more human experiences. And I've always been a writer since my youth, who has put great stock into the stories of real people. And I'm hoping that letters from Generation RX touches people because they are able to identify with the stories of their neighbors. And so often that influences us even more than what the government says or what the drug companies say about a drug or anything else, is to know what real people have experienced while on these medications.
Can you share with us, maybe not even a story that you've put into the film, but share with us a story or two and what it's meant to you, what you think it illustrates? Kevin?
Yes, absolutely. There was a...
I didn't mean to drop an unexpected question in your lap.
No. I actually, evidently, I hit the button in the wrong place. My apologies. There was a letter that I received from I wish I had it in front of me, but I don't at the moment. But there was a letter from a young woman named Brianna who wrote to me and said, I just saw your film Generation RX. And she actually said, and this was mind-blowing to me, that this was the first time that she had ever heard of people who voiced any kind of opposition to the cavalier use of these medicines, particularly among children and teens. And that just blew my mind that somehow this film had been produced and so many people like you have been at this for 40 plus years and that this information still has so far to go in terms of reaching everyday people who probably just use the mainstream media and whatever other outlets to get their news these days. So, I mean, it was a very touching, very heartfelt letter about how she felt that, 10 or 13 years of her life had been basically stolen and that she would never get them back, but that she was so heartened by the fact that this film came out and it was told the other side of the story, if you will. And, the film itself has been criticized by drugging forces, I guess is the way to put it, as not showing, quote, the benefit to some people of these meds. I'm not even remotely sensitive to that because the right on the DVD cover and in the title description of Generation RX, it said we've been told this story, as you well know, for decades by government officials, by the drug companies, of course, by medicine in general, by journalists, that they were, quote, safe and effective for these conditions, and that Generation RX was really dedicated to telling the other side of the story so that people could evaluate all the information for themselves and then make their own personal choice in terms of what was best for them. And at least then, as you know, Peter, at least then they would be armed with, you know, maybe not all the information, but a breadth of information by which they could make an intelligent choice. So that was one letter that really impacted me dramatically.
You know, this idea of people having years of their lives or their childhood stolen is not an exaggeration. And often people have no idea about what's really hit them. They have no idea of how much they have lost. I'm seeing people in their mid-20s, you know, who are really in a state of really chronic psychosis, chronic disturbed and broken thinking. And it wasn't like that before they started on the drugs when they were 6, 8, or 10, or 12 years old. And they've really just gone down this hill.
Exactly.
Without hardly even appreciating what's happened to them. And, of course, their families have had such bad experiences with them when they try to come off the drugs because they go into withdrawal that they're then afraid to even support drug withdrawal, even if they want to, because they're scared about what's going to happen. And there's got to be hundreds of thousands of people now, millions in this position.
I would think so. And as a matter of fact, your comments prompt another of the stories that is featured in Letters from Generation RX, which will be completed within the next 2 to 3 months. And that's a beautiful young lady named Melissa Binstock, whom I had the great joy and honor of interviewing. And Melissa was initially diagnosed at the age of 6. She had some tics and some, as you know, some vocal outbursts and some other things. The parents really weren't in favor of medication initially, but finally they felt like they had to do something. So they had a family friend who was a psychiatrist, at the way they put it was, quote, a close friend. And so Melissa was put on, you know, a number of medications, as you know. One medication caused another adverse event or effect, and then another one, and then another one. And before too long, she was on, I think it was 16 medications or something by the time she was 12. And, you know, she began cutting herself, and she really had a very traumatic life. And one of the beautiful things about this new film is that we're not only exploring some of the tragedies, which you just, as you know, just are inescapable, but also some of the, quote, success stories, the positive aspects of people who have survived this. And one very beautiful thing that Melissa says in the film is that she feels it's so important that if parents are going to choose this route for their child, that the child has to be themselves kind of fully informed, because she spent, as she says, 10, 12 years or more going through all of these side effects or real effects of these medications, not knowing it was the drugs that were causing them, of course, and then thinking that it was her brain that was broken, that the problem was within her and not within the medications. So she makes a very heartfelt plea that at the very least, parents need to be very upfront and open, saying this drug may not work, this drug may have this effect. If it does, please tell us. And being more aggressive about the sharing of information, even with young children as young as 6 and 8 and 10 years old. So Melissa is one of the inspiring stories featured in Letters from Generation RX.
What do you think about my looking ahead and publishing this article in the journal called Children and Society, Childhood and Society, calling for professionals to start to think about saying, no, we don't want to do this. We don't think children should be given psychoactive substances, period. That's just not what we should do to them. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, obviously, I admire you immensely, and I admire everything that you've fought to bring to the public, forum over the last 40 years. You and I, you know, the beauty of our relationship, I think, is that we really respect one another. I mean, I agree personally. If it were my children, I certainly agree with that wholeheartedly. I don't go quite as far as you do to say that they should all be, banned or anything like that, because I believe in something called medical freedom of choice. But inherent in that, Peter, is the idea that there is no more nonsense, that we share the breadth of all the information with everyone, and that the studies are made available online for free to everyone. You know, I mean, this industry, this cottage industry that's popped up, Selvier and some of the other ones that dominate the, quote, academic publishing world, and you have to pay, $50 to just go read a study that's been put out about one of these psychiatric drugs. I think that's a crime in itself, and I think that, we need to, if $1 of taxpayer money is going to help fund these studies, either in academia or by the drug companies themselves, which is happening, as you know as well or better than I, then we have the right to have access to that information. And while I might agree with you personally in terms of my principles about the use of these medications, particularly among children, I do like to reserve that people should have their own, personal choice if they're given all the information humanly possible that we are aware of, scientific and otherwise, about these drugs.
This is a really interesting question. I'd love to spend a little more time on it. Do you mind if we talk about it a little more?
No, not at all.
I think it's very interesting. This came up in the beginning for me around lobotomy and psychosurgery. Mm-hmm. And after I saw what in the 70s, and and some of my listeners, I conducted an international campaign, took a lot of years out of my life, and actually pretty much stopped almost all but a handful of the projects in the Western world, and they're creeping back now. And I concluded that physicians should not be allowed to mutilate the brains of people, that they shouldn't be allowed. And as much as that, at the time I thought of myself as a libertarian, I'm a little bit more confused now as to how I think of myself politically. But then I thought of myself as a libertarian. I didn't want to ban anything. They'll let people get what they want.
Right.
But, you can't go to a physician and ask him to murder you. It's not legal. Some states would allow euthanasia, I suppose, but certainly not just, I want to die, murder me. And so we clearly put limits on what physicians can do. We don't allow physicians to give poisons, outright poisons in the guise of drugs. In fact, we don't allow physicians to prescribe anything that hasn't been approved by the FDA.
Right.
And basically what I'm saying, but I'm also just evolving it as I think about it with you, I just think it's important for me to think about, maybe for all of us, should we have physicians giving children, empowering parents to ask to give children substances which we know are going to damage their brain, corrupt their whole experience of life, because these things are going to get right in those neurotransmitters and mingle around in them and disrupt neural transmission while the brain is growing very fast and taking in information, and that it's going to leave the children never the same again when they grow up, that it's now turning out to be a gateway drug, latest studies, a gateway drug for becoming a lifetime psychiatric patient for many of these people, so that if you're diagnosed with ADHD in the 70s, even a very mild case of just being a little hyperactive as a kid, you now have a good chance of being a career mental patient, and compared to a control group, you're not going to live as long. You're going to be more suicidal. Your death rate is up, as I said. You're going to have higher incarcerations, higher mental hospitalizations. Should physicians be allowed to do that? So, I mean, the direction I've gone in is look, we're calling these things safe and effective, and we're empowering people to prescribe them. It's not like the parent themselves can go and inject this into their kid. They've got to have the cooperation of a physician, or else it's illegal, and they could be accused of child abuse. So I'm thinking under those conditions, all right, maybe we should allow people to put anything they want in their mouths, but should physicians be allowed to claim it's a treatment? That's kind of the way I'm going with it. I'd love to just chat with you a little bit about this. I think it could be interesting to people. It's a fundamental freedom issue.
Well, I agree. And I'd say two things to that. Number one, first and foremost, you know, you mentioned twice the FDA and their quote, definition of safe and effective. This is supposedly the gold standard by which all drugs in this country are approved. It's been that way since the changes in the 1960s that you well know, which made randomized controlled trials the, quote, gold standard by which these drugs were studied and then approved as they were deemed safe and effective. So the FDA often escapes any direct criticism in our society, certainly from the media, and even a lot of academics that I've interviewed in the past, while they might agree with you 100% in what you're saying, they seem to give the FDA a pass. Now, you know, my background, being a studying journalism and then becoming a filmmaker in my 20s, was really a little bit opposite. I came in through the FDA because I was examining the FDA's role in public health way back when, before I was specifically introduced into the world of psychiatric drugs, which really began for me in 1993, hard to believe, 21 years ago, when I first saw the tapes of the 1991 Prozac hearings. So, you know, for me, it's an ethical issue regarding the FDA, and that, you know, we need to reform the FDA, the mission of the FDA, and the impact of the FDA. We keep giving them more money, expanding their power, giving them more opportunity to affect the lives of Americans, and it hasn't been a positive experience, with the exception of a few specific areas where they do a good job. I mean, you could even say, look at all the seafood, the problems with mercury and seafood, everything else. They are the Food and Drug Administration, and yet they seem to neglect the core of their mission, their original mission, which, in terms of food, I really think it's become neglectful. So that's number one thing. That's number one. Number two, should physicians be allowed to prescribe these drugs, particularly for children? Well, I don't have to tell you, Peter, that the vast majority of these drugs are not prescribed by psychiatrists. They're prescribed by pediatricians and general practitioners who, for the most part, have little, if any, understanding of the impact or potential impact or the adverse events attributable to these drugs when they prescribe them. When you're sitting in my position as someone who has conversations and interviews experts like yourself, people within the government, even attorneys that have brought some of these suits forward, and most importantly to me in the terms of these stories, these humanistic stories, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of families who have suffered the adverse events of these drugs, it's very clear that this very cavalier approach that we've taken towards the prescribing of these drugs is harming our children. I really don't think that there's any debate about that. However, if you go to, as you've been to many of these SSRI antidepressant hearings, FDA holds, I guess, every 10 years or so on the safety of these drugs, you will see, you know, a child 10 years old or 12 begging the FDA, please don't take them off the market. Let me have access to my drugs. They've saved my life. So again, you know, it's complicated in terms of personal medical freedom of choice, which I am a proponent of. And yet, on the other hand, the doctors, to some degree, being kept in the dark by the FDA, mm-hmm. by the drug companies, most certainly, and even by science.
Kevin, let me interrupt. We're running a little over our break because I didn't want to interrupt. Kevin Miller, filmmaker Generation RX, will be back and continue what I think is a really important social ethical issue. Back after the music with Kevin Miller. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. I want to tell you how much I think of Kevin Miller. I'm going to be really featuring him at the next two opportunities I have to do that in this lifetime. One of those opportunities is next April. It's coming April in 2015. And this is already up on our empathic therapy website. We're going to be holding a conference. It's going to be an official conference of the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, and we're doing it in cooperation with Bertram Caron, who's a professor emeritus at Michigan State University, and it's going to be at Michigan State, and it's going to be April 17th, 18th, and 19th, and on the 18th, right now, I've got Kevin Miller scheduled to be there. I hope you've got it on your schedule, Kevin.
Indeed, I do.
And then I'm going to be doing a conference in Syracuse that's a part of our organization. I'm doing it in cooperation with Michael Gilbert, who has his own nonprofit. Michael is really responsible for this conference, but we're co-sponsoring. And again, sooner, if you live on the East Coast, October 30th, Kevin is going to be a part of a day where I'm the coordinator, the introducer, and one of the speakers, and we're going to give him extra time. We're going to give each speaker extra time. There's going to be a few really good people. And that's going to be in Syracuse, October 30th of this year. And the other, again, April in Michigan. You can find these things on the web. I'll tell you more about it as we go along. Kevin, I bet you've been thinking thoughts while we were gone. You want to continue?
Well, yeah. I think that the thing is that the hardest thing, I think, for Americans, and this is where, you know, your role, few other people, is just so critical, is that they have such a tiny understanding of how policy and how actually governmental entities really affect their daily lives. And, you know, as you've been stating for so many decades now, you know, the bar for approval of these psychiatric drugs has been so low. I mean, you know, just looking at Prozac off the top, which you are an expert in, literally and legally and otherwise, it's so low that if people even knew that, which they will discover in Letters from Generation RX when it comes out, we cover this in great detail, and I interviewed you extensively about this. But, Peter, if they even knew how low the bar was for the approval of these drugs and how, for example, the standard, well, you can fail 14 tests, and then if one trial is just by the skinniest hair more effective than placebo, then it gets approved. If the American public and the world public were aware of how shoddy the science often is and has been to pass these drugs, these very powerful drugs, I think that alone, just that information alone, would make them say, well, wait a minute. I need to explore this further, don't you?
Yes, just to editorially tweak what you said, it's actually, as you know, two studies, but they can do as many as they want to get two statistically significant studies. And if you can't buy researchers whom you've been paying for maybe 20 years, you know, as your stable of researchers, if you can't pay them enough to manage to produce some data that you and your corporate headquarters can turn into a positive statistical event, you know, you don't know what you're doing. Because not only are these studies too short, some as short as 3 weeks. One of the Adderall approval studies was 3 weeks.
Well,
I mean, not only are they short and too small and too twisted, but the whole thing isn't done by, quote, scientists. It's done by paid lackeys who just send information in to the head offices of the drug companies who then do all the statistical work and all the statistical manipulation. And it's a tragic, absolutely tragic situation. I'm glad you're going to deal with that in the movie. I'm glad to hear that.
Well, I think it's important because, you know, I certainly didn't intend when I got into this field to necessarily even be in this genre for so long. But I'm sorry?
I said, yeah, it happens to folks. I mean, you confront such evil that it's hard to let it go and go on and do something else.
Well, that's right. And I guess, you know, I look at it as many people do, as a civil rights issue. And you know, for me, when I examine all of this, part of the reason that I try to absorb as much as I can as a layman in studying this is so that I can impart as much information to people that is digestible, if you will, things that they can understand in a way that they can understand. And so, you know, I just gave you the one example and, you know, we're covering some of the other aspects about Lilly and the approval of Prozac and how, just laying out for people between FDA, between Lilly, between others, how this came to be. And I think that's really important information for people. I mean, you know, whenever we have a scandal in this country about anything, it could be anything. Pick a topic, but you know, go back 25 years and say, okay, Iran-Contra. Well, when the facts become known about some of the acts that were being done that were generated by our government at an arm's length at the time, you know, naturally the public they look at this behavior and they just coil back. And then they hopefully speak out and take action. And in the same way, I feel like, you know, your work of 40 plus years and putting this on people's radar and speaking to people directly about what you've experienced both in the courts as a legal expert and most certainly as a professional and as a thought leader. You know, I mean, we're coming to the stage now where I really feel like we are on the cusp of something very, very critical and very important, a breakthrough. And I'm hoping, of course, that Letters from Generation RX plays a role in that. But if it does, it's only because of the people, you know, who I was blessed to interview and the information that I've been able to garner and share with people so that hopefully this is a common sense A to B all the way through to Z kind of story so that people will get to the end of the film and they'll say, my God, I mean, how did we allow it to get to this stage? We need to change this. And I think we're getting close to that stage. Can you believe it, Peter? After 40-plus years of your dedication to this issue, I really do feel like we are on the cusp of creating very serious, meaningful change. And what a blessing that would be.
I hope so. I certainly feel a sea change in the public. Changing the FDA or psychiatry, I think, is extremely remote. It would take a cataclysmic event, but I think we're moving. I agree with you. When is Letters from Generation RX going to be available, and how will people be able to get it?
Well, the first thing is that, you know, as I said, the film will be complete within the next few months, and then, you know, the very first thing we'll do from there is either talk to film distributors and or television networks, and I have been in discussion with some, which is very different than when I released Generation RX. We had no prospects at that time.
Oh, this is great news, Kevin. I don't think I knew this. This is great news.
Yeah, we've actually been approached already by some people. But again, for me, I'm going to be a little bit more particular. I'm going to make certain that if we do align with someone, that it's a good fit. And if not, then we'll continue to explore through film festivals and other for a major distributor. Or we will just release directly to the public. So sometime, certainly before the end of the year, the film will be out and we will know what the exact distribution schedule is. But I'm more excited than I've ever been, Peter, because I believe that we do have an audience now. The last film was 4 or 5 years ahead of the curve. And I think that the timing on this one will be perfect. People are ready to hear the message, and most certainly, and somewhat shockingly, the media has been picking up where Generation RX left off over the last few years, and we're beginning to see more and more and more of these stories reported, aren't we? So, you know, we never know what kind of reverberative effect that your work or mine has on the media, but I do believe that that they are picking up finally on the fact that this is an extremely serious, timely, and relevant issue. And hopefully letters from Generation RX will capitalize on that.
Now, in the meanwhile, folks, if you haven't seen Gen X, Generation RX, you can get it on Netflix, right?
And Amazon. It's on Amazon for, I think it's only $1.99 or something for 7 days. You can watch it as many times as you want or what have you. So a lot of people take advantage of that and don't even have to purchase the actual DVD. And, you know, that's been a great weapon for us to get the word out. And Netflix has been incredible. I don't know what the status is on Netflix right now because we had a 5-year or 4-year deal with them. But I know in America it did extremely well, and in Canada it did remarkably well. And you know, I keep getting letters from people every single day of people that have seen it and been gracious enough with me to share their comments. So, yeah, it's still out there and hopefully making an impact.
And for those of you who just tuned in, I've broken all my precedents by making Kevin the only person I've done a financial pitch for. And it's really not, as Ginger said, it's not for Kevin. It's for Generation RX and letters from Generation RX. And you can contribute to the finishing of that film by going to Ginger and my website for our organization by going to the website of the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy.
Right.
And it's empathictherapy.org, and you'll find a place where you can press some buttons and make a contribution to the film. We were in the middle of talking about this issue of calling for a ban, and I'm still doing a lot of thinking about that, and how much I want eventually to push for that or not to push for it. I think what I want to make clear is that no child should ever be drugged. There's just no reason to drug a child. There are no children who can't be reached in one way or another by the concerted efforts of loving and wise people. And we don't provide those efforts anymore, because we think we can drug them. And the more we drug them, the less we will educate and raise them. I think it's like a mathematical equation. The more you believe that your kids are defective or your students are defective and that you should send them to the local doc for drugs, the less you're going to be inventive, creative, loving, and inspired. in how you solve the problems and the conflicts you're having with these children. It's almost always about conflict between parents and authorities. And right. It's up to us as the authorities to find ways to reach our children, whether it's an autistic child or a violent and angry and hurt child. It's in our hands to do the best we can to reach out emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, educationally, ethically, however you define what we need to give to kids and to give to them. And it is the only way to really legitimately help our children grow and overcome their struggles.
Well, one of the many things that's so beautiful about the Center for Empathic Therapy is the fact that, you know, the people that come to see you as their, as, you know, your patients, they know that they're getting someone who's deeply committed to those principles, who's deeply committed to empathy, to holding people accountable, to knowing how to converse with young people and others and how to challenge them and get their minds around issues in different ways. And part of what troubles me most, Peter, and I think you and I have probably discussed this before, but is that, you know, what we really need is to have your places like the center and others be funded for to train more empathic therapists and therapists in general. I mean, we have an entire generation of children and adults who have lost the opportunity to engage with someone like you because of the psychopharmacology that has literally taken over American medicine like a tidal wave. And, you know, this is part of the challenge of where we find ourselves right now. People say, oh, well, if you don't give them the drugs, you know, what are my options? Well, there's perhaps cognitive behavioral therapy. There's maybe a nutritional element. Maybe there's this. But in truth, we don't have as many, certainly people like you are exceedingly rare, so immensely qualified and so tremendously effective with patients. And, you know, what we need are more people who are committed to those principles and can execute those principles with their patients. Because I agree with you wholeheartedly that particularly with children, this is exactly what is needed. But unfortunately, the well is dried up because of insurance reasons and all the things that you're all too familiar with. That, you know, insurance doesn't cover much of this anymore. And so we've put ourselves into this position because we put all of our eggs in the pharmaceutical basket, if you will. And it's created this this nightmarish situation that as a society we find ourselves in today.
My only caveat is I don't look upon myself as somehow tremendously effective. Those are great words. Doing therapy is about relationship, and it's about patience, and it's about two people. And I don't think that there are any great therapists. I think there are really good relationships, therapeutic relationships that can work out very, very well. And for some people, making a great relationship or a good relationship with me may not be difficult. For others, it may be impossible. And I think we just need a variety of good people approaching therapy in all kinds of varied ways. And we need a wide open approach to this. And what I've tried to establish at our center, we have some guidelines on the center that a couple of dozen of my colleagues signed on to and helped with a little bit, to just kind of get, you know, get at the generic aspects of this. The no involuntary treatment and no drugs is a starting point, and as another starting point, to treasuring the people you deal with, really treating folks like they matter a great deal, that they have great value, as all of us should see ourselves and all of us should be treated. And so we're working really hard to get the basic principles across of what good therapy relationships are like. But I I tremble a little bit at the thought of there being great therapists, including me.
Well, that's great. I appreciate your humility on that, but I think it's reality.
It's reality, too.
Well, that's great, and I understand. I understand your perspective. However true that may or may not be, there are also great, I mean, there are proficient and even great communicators, and you know, maybe one of the blessings that will come out of this tidal wave of change that we both seem to be sensing as a possibility, at least, is that we will be able to train en masse a new generation of therapists. And boy, if that alone were to happen, if they were committed to the kinds of principles that you've been and so many others have been in this country, that would be a terrific change, wouldn't it?
Well, it would be. I keep looking for avenues to do that. I do teach at a graduate school at SUNY Oswego in the Department of Counseling, and I just hold very small seminars where I work with students on things like how to do therapy. It's going to be really difficult. It's going to have to be done outside the establishment. There are very few universities which will be brave enough, honorable enough, informed enough to want to train people who don't believe in the medical model and aren't going to bring in research funds from the pharmaceutical industry and who might even upset the local medical school. So I think the training of decent therapists got to figure out ways to do it outside of the establishment. And I keep looking for somebody and for folks to work with me on that. That may be one of the things I never get to do, but I'd love to see it. I'm glad you bring it up. We need networks for training therapists. I don't believe that a good therapist even needs a high school degree other than to show he could finish high school or is responsible enough to. A good therapist, the requirements for a training program should be that you're a good person, that other people like you and think you're a good human being, that you want to help folks and relate to folks and you like people. And you have some very good ideas about personal responsibility, at least to start with. In other words, we should be picking people to be therapists based on their human qualities, their human assets, not on their degrees or how well they did in school. The worst therapists I ever saw in my life were when I went to my first year residency at Harvard, and everybody there except me had straight A's. You know, I'd gotten into the top programs because I had, you know, done these, amazing work as a college student in state mental hospitals and run this program and met all these professors and started writing books and so on when I was a college kid. So that's how I got to the top. It wasn't by being straight A's. I had straight A's one semester, I think, at Harvard. These people had straight A's right through, and they'd taken all the medical courses they could, and they were, you know, your top physicians. And by the time they tried to talk with people as first-year residents in psychiatry, they didn't know how to relate to ordinary folks, let alone to somebody who was so disturbed in their human relationships that they got sent into the hospital.
Right.
So I think we need to bypass the whole selection system we have and have to find a way to set up competing therapy programs, some of which at least are based on empathic principles and choosing people on the basis of their human qualities. We got about 3 minutes. We got 2 minutes, maybe less. Well, Kevin,
one of the things is that, you know, you were talking about the London conference in 2015, which I'm very much, you know, I'm so anxious to,
yes,
to
that's
go.
Yes, still in the works. I don't know if it's going to happen. It's still in the works,
well,
but go ahead.
The point is that Dr. Joanna Moncrief, of course, is one of the people that's with the organization that you mentioned. And, you know, you have people that have had their, and I'm not referring to Dr. Moncrief personally because I've never met her, but you have people that have agreed with you on many of these issues and maybe had their both, you know, one foot in each world, if you will, for quite a while, because they just couldn't believe the extreme truths that have sort of been revealed. But now they're becoming, I don't want to use the word radicalized, I mean, they're just injected with the truth, and so therefore they're making dramatic shifts in how they're presenting and communicating these issues to their peers, to their patients, to the people around them, to the world. And I think, you know, we may underestimate a little bit, I used the George W. Bush phrase there, misunderestimate. We may underestimate a little bit the impact of just this coming change that we're experiencing right now, and the impact, how it will, reverberate out into the communities that follow them. And so I'm more hopeful that people are going to be looking for extreme changes and continue the kind of ideas that you've been putting forth.
Thank
for so
you,
long.
Kevin. Thank you. We're ending the show now with Kevin Miller. Go to empathictherapy.org and you can contribute to Kevin's new film. What a wonderful thing to be proud of. Thank you, my wonderful listeners.